for the Advancement of Academic Scientific Study. They were inducted into the National Inventors Hall of Fame in 1994. 1958. Helen Free, a biochemist and expert on urine analysis, invents the home diabetes test. She and her husband were inducted to the National Inventors Hall of Fame in 2000. 1964. Dorothy Crowfoot Hodgkin, a British biochemist and crystallographer, wins the 1964 Nobel Prize in Chemistry for using X-ray techniques to determine the structures of biologically important molecules, including penicillin, vitamin B12, vitamin D, and insulin. 1964. Chemist Stephanie Louise Kwolek invents Kevlar, a polymer fiber that is 5 times stronger than the same weight of steel and is now used in bulletproof vests, helmets, trampolines, tennis rackets, tires, and many other common objects. 1966. Lillian Gilbreth becomes the first woman to be elected to the National Academy of Engineering. This inventor, author, industrial engineer, industrial psychologist, and mother of 12 children patented many kitchen appliances, including an electric food mixer, shelves inside refrigerator doors, and the foot pedal lid opening trash can. In her work on ergonomics, she interviewed over 4,000 women to design the proper height for stoves, sinks, and other kitchen fixtures. 1975. Physicist Betsy Anker Johnson becomes the fourth woman elected to the National Academy of Engineering, one of the highest honors an engineer can receive. 1975. Dr. Qianxing Wu is elected the first woman president of the American Physical Society. The nuclear physicist studied beta decay, worked on the Manhattan Project, and helped develop more sensitive Geiger counters. 1983. Barbara McClintock, an American scientist and cytogenicist, becomes the first woman to win, unshared, the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine for her discovery of a genetic mechanism called transposition. 1984. Francis Gabe invents the self-cleaning house. Each room of the house has a 10-inch square cleaning, drying, heating, cooling device on the ceiling. At the push of a button, the cleaning unit sends a powerful spray of soapy water around the room and then rinses and blow-dries everything. Each room has a sloped floor to aid the water drainage, and all valuable objects and other things that should not get wet are stored under glass. The house in the woods of Oregon also has self-cleaning sinks, bathtubs, and toilets, a cupboard that doubles as a dishwasher, and closets that can clean and dry the clothes hung inside them. 1988. Gertrude Bell Elion is awarded the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine. The biochemist invented many life-saving drugs, now commonly used to fight leukemia and other diseases. 1991. Chemist Edith Flanagan is awarded the Perkin Medal, the nation's most distinguished honor in applied chemistry. She was the first woman ever to have received the award. She retired in 1994, having earned 108 U.S. patents in the fields of petroleum research and product development. 1993. Ellen Ochoa becomes the first Hispanic female astronaut in space. The veteran of 3 space flights, who has logged over 719 hours in space, is also an electrical engineer with patents on high-tech optical recognition systems and optical systems for spacecraft automation. 1993. Betty Rozier and Lisa Valino, a mother and daughter team, invent the intravenous catheter shield, making the use of IVs in hospitals safer and easier. 1995. Physical chemist Isabella Helen Legowski-Carl receives the National Medal of Science for her work on the structure of molecules. 1997. Dr. Rosalind Sussman Yalow wins the Nobel Prize in Medicine for her 1959 invention of RIA, a revolutionary way to diagnose illness at the molecular level. 1999. Eye surgeon Dr. Patricia Bath becomes the first African-American woman doctor to receive a patent for a medical invention, a device that removes cataracts with a fiber optic laser. Explorers. Amelia Earhart. Amelia Mary Earhart, born in 1897, was a pilot who received the Distinguished Flying Cross and worldwide fame for being the first woman to fly solo across the Atlantic Ocean. During World War I, she trained as a nurse's aide through the Red Cross and worked in a hospital in Ontario, Canada, until after the war ended in 1918. Around that time, she saw her first flying exhibition and was captivated. She stood her ground when one of the pilots flew low to buzz the crowd, and later said of the experience, "I did not understand it at the time, but I believe that little red airplane said something to me as it swished by." The next year, she visited an airfield and was given a ride. A few hundred feet in the air, and she was hooked. She began working odd jobs, including driving a truck and working at a telephone company, to earn money for flying lessons with female aviator Anita Netta Snook. After 6 months of lessons, she bought her own plane, a used yellow biplane that she nicknamed the Canary, and in October 1922, she flew it to an altitude of 14,000 feet, setting a world record for women pilots. In May 1923, Earhart became the 16th woman to be issued a pilot's license by the Fédération Aéronautique Internationale, FAI. She not only broke aviation records, she also formed a women's flying organization, the 99s, and wrote best-selling books. She was the first woman to fly across the Atlantic, the first woman to fly across the Atlantic alone, and the first person, man or woman, to fly across the Atlantic alone twice. Earhart was also the first woman to fly an autogyro, a kind of flying craft, and the first person to cross the United States in an autogyro, the first person to fly solo across the Pacific between Honolulu and Oakland, California, the first person to fly solo nonstop from Mexico City to Newark, New Jersey, and the first woman to fly nonstop coast to coast across the United States. Her final accomplishment was becoming an enduring mystery. At age 39, in 1937, Amelia Earhart disappeared over the Pacific Ocean during an attempt at making a circumnavigational flight. The official search efforts lasted 9 days, but Amelia Earhart was never found. Alexandra David Nail. Alexandra David Nail, born Louise Eugenie Alexandrine Marie David, 1868 to 1969, was the first European woman to travel to the forbidden city of Lhasa, Tibet, in 1924, when it was still closed to foreigners. She was a French explorer, spiritualist, Buddhist, and writer, penning over 30 books on Eastern religion, philosophy, and the experiences she had on her travels. By the time she was 18, she had already made solo trips to England, Spain, and Switzerland, and when she was 22, she went to India, returning to France only when she ran out of money. She married railroad engineer Philippe Nail in 1904, and in 1911, she returned to India to study Buddhism at the Royal Monastery of Sikkim, where she met the Crown Prince Sidkion Tulku. In 1912, she met the 13th Dalai Lama twice and was able to ask him questions about Buddhism. She deepened her study of spirituality when she spent 2 years living in a cave in Sikkim, near the Tibetan border. It was there that she met the young Sikkimese monk, Abfer Yungden, who became her lifelong traveling companion and whom she would later adopt. The two trespassed into Tibetan territory in 1916. Meeting the Panchen Lama, but were evicted by British authorities. They left for Japan, traveled through China, and in 1924 arrived in Lhasa, Tibet, disguised as pilgrims. They lived there for 2 months. In 1928, Alexandra separated from her husband and settled in Digne, France, where she spent the next 10 years writing books about her adventures. She reconciled with her husband and traveled again with her adopted son in 1937, at age 69, going through the Soviet Union to China, India, and eventually Tachianlu, where she continued her study of Tibetan literature. It was an arduous journey that took nearly 10 years to complete. She returned to Digne in 1946 to settle the estate of her husband, who had died in 1941, and again wrote books and gave lectures about what she had seen. Her last camping trip, at an alpine lake in early winter, 2,240 meters above sea level, was at age 82. She lived to be 100, dying just 18 days before her 101st birthday. Freya Stark. Dame Freya Madeline Stark, 1893-1993, was a British travel writer, explorer, and cartographer. She was one of the first Western women to travel the Arabian deserts and was fluent in Arabic and several other languages. She traveled to Turkey, the Middle East, Greece, and Italy, but her passion was the Middle East. When she was 35, she explored the forbidden territory of the Syrian Druze, traveling through the Valley of the Assassins before being thrown into a military prison. In the 1930s, she went to the outback of southern Arabia, where few Westerners had explored, and discovered the hidden roots of the ancient incense trade. During World War II, she joined the Ministry of Information and helped create propaganda to encourage Arabic support of the Allies. Even in her 60s, she continued her travels, retracing Alexander the Great's journey into Asia and writing 3 more books based on those trips. By the time of her death, at age 100, she had written 24 books on her adventures. Florence Baker. Lady Florence Baker, 1841-1916, was born Barbara Maria Sass. She was orphaned at 7, and at age 17 she was due to be sold in an Ottoman slave market in Hungary when a 38-year-old English widower, Sam Baker, paid for her and rescued her from her captors. She was renamed Florence, and years later, she became Samuel Baker's wife. They were a perfect match. Sam was an established explorer, and Florence a natural-born adventurer, and so the two of them traveled to Africa, searching for the source of the Nile and shooting big game. They managed to reach the secondary source of the Nile, which they called Lake Albert in honor of Queen Victoria's recently deceased husband, and then in 1865 they made the journey to Britain, where they married, and where she met her stepchildren, Sam's children by his first wife, and where Sam received a knighthood. They returned to Africa in 1870 to report on the slave trade along the Nile. Later they journeyed to India and Japan before returning to Britain. Florence outlived Sam by 23 years and was cared for in her old age by her stepchildren. Writing letters. Writing good old-fashioned letters has somewhat fallen out of style with the advent of technology and the tempting immediacy of email, instant messaging, and texting. But there are still circumstances where a typed or handwritten formal letter is required that calls for something more personal and professional than "see you later, kisses, thanks, bye." The thank you letter. When you receive a gift or other form of hospitality, it is polite to send a thank you note or letter in response, and it is most polite to have the letter be handwritten. Begin by greeting the person, and then start the letter right away by saying thank you. You don't have to get fancy with an introduction. The whole point of the letter is to say thanks, so start with that. A simple thank you for your gift will do. Then mention how the gift will come in handy for you, or if writing in response to a favor or gesture of hospitality, how useful their actions were to you. I really appreciated being able to stay with you when I visited New York last week. If you can, it's always nice to mention looking forward to seeing them at some future event. Then say thanks again and wrap up the letter by signing off with love, with gratitude, yours truly, or your preferred way of closing. A brief example. Dear Aunt Jessie, thanks so much for the fantastic roller skates. I can't wait to use them at the skating party next month. When you come visit over the summer, maybe we can go skating together. Thanks again. Love, Emmy. Personal letters. Longer than a thank you note, a personal letter, or social note, has 5 parts and can be handwritten or typed. The heading. This consists of your address and the date, each on its own line, indented to the middle of the page. After the heading, skip a line. If you are writing on pre-addressed stationery, just write the date. The greeting. This can be formal or informal, beginning with dear or just writing the person's name, or even simply hi. Either way, the greeting ends with a comma, and you skip a line afterwards. The body. The main text of your letter. In this kind of letter, the beginning of each paragraph is indented, and no lines are skipped between paragraphs. The closing. After the body, skip a line and write your closing line, which is usually just a few words like, all best, sincerely, looking forward to seeing you, with love, etc. Whatever you write, this line should end in a comma and should be indented the same amount as your heading. The signature line. This is where you sign your name. If you are typing the letter, skip 3 lines after the closing and type your name there. Then put your handwritten signature just above your printed name. If your letter contains a postscript, skip a line after the signature line, begin the postscript by writing P.S., and end it with your initials. An additional postscript should be noted as P.P.S. rather than P.S.S., as it is a post, after, postscript, and not a postscript script. Women spies. From the Revolutionary War to World War II. Unlikely spies. Julia Child. Before she became a famous chef, Julia Child was a spy. She worked for the Office of Strategic Services, a precursor of the CIA, and went undercover to Sri Lanka, called Ceylon at the time, with top security clearance. In World War II, she helped the U.S. Navy solve their problem with sharks, who had a habit of setting off underwater explosive devices, foiling U.S. plans to blow up German U-boats by developing shark repellent. She met diplomat Paul Child when she was working for the OSS, and they married. When Paul was posted to Paris, Julia trained at the famous Cordon Bleu cooking school and began her second life as a chef. Hedy Lamarr. Hedwig Eva Maria Kiesler is best known as Hedy Lamarr, movie star of the 1930s and 40s. But she was also an inventor who patented an idea that was to become the key to modern wireless communication. During World War II, Hedy, along with George Antheil, invented a way to make military communication secure through frequency hopping, an early form of a technology called spread spectrum. Hedy's status as a beautiful and successful actress provided her with the perfect cover. She was able to visit a variety of venues on tour and interact with many people, none of whom suspected that the stunning starlet might be listening closely and thinking of ways to help the U.S. cause. Josephine Baker. Josephine Baker was another World War II-era entertainer whose celebrity status helped distract from her mission as a spy. Josephine was an African-American dancer and singer from St. Louis, Missouri. She found some success in the United States, but was hindered by racial prejudice. She moved to Paris when she was 19 and became an international star. When World War II began, she started working as an undercover operative for the French Resistance, transporting orders and maps from the Resistance into countries occupied by Germany. Her fame and renown made it easy for her to pass unsuspected, as foreign officials were thrilled to meet such a famous performer, but she wrote the secret information in disappearing ink on her sheet music, just in case. The Girl Guides. During the First World War, the Girl Guides, the British version of Girl Scouts, were used as couriers for secret messages by MI5, Britain's counterintelligence agency. Messengers were needed to work in the War Office at the time, and at first Boy Scouts were used. But they proved to be difficult to manage, so Girl Guides were asked to serve instead. The girls, most of whom were between 14 and 18 years old, ran messages and patrolled on the roof. For their efforts, they were paid 10 shillings a week, plus food. Like all employees of MI5, they took a pledge of secrecy. But unlike many employees of MI5, they were among the least likely spies to arouse suspicion. Revolutionary War Spies. During the Revolutionary War, many women up and down the East Coast passed important information along to General Washington at Valley Forge. Philadelphian Lydia Barrington Darrah spied on the British for American officers. Two loyalists, citizens loyal to Britain, Miss Jenny and Anne Bates, spied on the Americans for the British. Anne Trotter Bailey carried messages across enemy territory, as did Sarah Bradley Fulton, nicknamed the mother of the Boston Tea Party. Emily Geiger rode 50 miles through enemy territory to deliver information to General Sumter. The anonymous spy 355, a numerical code that meant lady or woman, was a member of the Culper Ring, a New York-based secret spy organization. She was seized by the British in 1780 and died on a prison ship, but not before she named Benedict Arnold as a potential traitor. Civil War Spies. Pauline Cushman was an actress who worked as a Union spy. She was captured with incriminating papers and sentenced to be executed, but was rescued just 3 days prior to her hanging. President Abraham Lincoln gave her the honorary commission of major, and she toured the country for years, telling of her exploits spying for the Union. Mary Elizabeth Bowser was a freed slave who served as a maid in the Confederate White House. Her servile status and the mistaken assumption that she could neither read nor write allowed her to be present for key conversations, but largely ignored. She smuggled important information and papers to the Union Army. Sarah Emma Edmonds disguised herself as a man so that she could serve in the Union Army, where she became known for her bravery and chameleon-like ability to blend in, whether she was masquerading as a black slave or disguised as a woman. She successfully fought for the Union as Frank Thompson until she became sick with malaria. She checked herself into a private hospital to avoid having to reveal her true identity. But when she learned that Frank Thompson was listed as a deserter, she came clean and worked as a nurse for the Union under her real name until the end of the war. She wrote about her experiences in a memoir titled Nurse and Spy in the Union Army. Rose O'Neill Greenhow spied so well for the Confederacy that Jefferson Davis credited her with winning the Battle of Manassas. She was in prison twice, once in her own home, and the second time with her 8-year-old daughter in Washington, D.C.'s Old Capitol Prison. After she was released from prison, she was exiled to the Confederate States, where Jefferson Davis enlisted her as a courier to Europe. Nancy Hart served as a Confederate spy, carrying messages between the Southern armies. When she was 20, she was captured by the Union. She was able to escape after shooting one of her guards with his own weapon. Elizabeth Van Loo was a spy for the North. She realized when she visited Union prisoners held by the Confederates in Richmond that they were excellent sources of information, as they had been marched through Confederate lines. Over the next 4 years, she worked as a spy, bringing food and clothing to Union prisoners and smuggling out information. For her efforts, she was made postmaster of Richmond by General Grant. Dr. Mary Edwards Walker was an abolitionist, a prisoner of war, a feminist, and a surgeon who dressed as a man and worked as a physician and spy for the Union. She is the only woman ever to receive the Congressional Medal of Honor. Harriet Tubman is most famous for her work in freeing slaves, but she also served with the Union Army in South Carolina, organizing a spy network and leading expeditions in addition to fighting as a soldier, working as a cook and a laundress, and aiding the wounded as a nurse. Through her experience with the Underground Railroad, leading more than 300 slaves to freedom. She came to know the landscape intimately and was able to recruit former slaves to be her eyes and ears, reporting on movements of the Confederate troops and scouting out the rebel camps. In 1863, she went on a gunboat raid with Colonel James Montgomery and several black soldiers that ultimately freed more than 700 slaves, thanks to the inside information from Harriet's scouts. Ginny and Lottie Moon were sisters who spied for the Confederates during the Civil War. Lottie began her career as a spy delivering messages for an underground Confederate organization at the behest of her husband. Ginny, too, delivered messages over Union lines on the pretext that she was meeting a beau. Ginny and the girl's mother risked considerable danger when they accepted a mission to retrieve sensitive papers and supplies from the Knights of the Golden Circle in Ohio. They were apprehended by Union agents. Ginny was able to swallow the most important written information they carried, but their cache of medical supplies was discovered and confiscated, and they were put under house arrest. Lottie came in disguise to plead with General Burnside, a former beau, for their release, but instead she was placed under arrest with her sister and mother. Ultimately, the charges were dropped. Lottie eventually became a journalist, and in the 1920s, Ginny headed to Hollywood, where she had bit parts in several movies, none of them with plots as exciting as the sisters' real-life adventures. World War I spies. Two famous and controversial World War I women spies, both of whom were executed, were Mata Hari, born Margareta Gertruda Zella MacLeod, and Edith Cavell. Mata Hari was a dancer who used her vocation as a cover for her spy work for the Germans. She was shot by the French as a spy in 1917. Edith Cavell was a British nurse who worked in Belgium during the war. She secretly helped British, French, and Belgian soldiers escape from behind the German lines, and she hid refugees in the nursing school she ran. By 1915, she had helped more than 200 British, French, and Belgian soldiers, but the Germans grew suspicious and arrested her. She was executed by firing squad. World War II spies. Virginia Hall, an American originally from Baltimore, Maryland, spied for the French during World War II. She was chased by the Nazis over the Pyrenees Mountains into Spain and eluded them, even though she had a wooden leg. After escaping, she trained as a radio operator and transferred to the OSS, America's secret spy agency. In 1943, she returned to France as an undercover spy, gathering intelligence, helping to coordinate airdrops in support of D-Day, and working with the French underground to disrupt German communications. After the war, Virginia was awarded America's Distinguished Service Cross, the only American civilian woman to receive such an honor. She continued to work for the OSS, and later the CIA, until her retirement in 1966. Princess Noor Unnissa Inayat Khan was an author and heroine of the French Resistance. The princess trained as a wireless operator in Great Britain and was sent into occupied France as a spy with the code name Madeleine. She became the sole communications link between her unit of the French Resistance and home base before she was captured by the Gestapo and executed. Violette Bushell Szabo was recruited and trained by the British Special Operations Executive after her husband, a member of the French Foreign Legion, was killed in North Africa. She was sent to France, where she was captured during a shootout. She refused to give up her information and was sent to the Ravensbrück concentration camp, where she was eventually killed. She was awarded the George Cross and the Croix de Guerre posthumously in 1946. Amy Elizabeth Thorpe, also known as Betty Pack and codename Cynthia, was an American spy first recruited by the British Secret Service and later by the American OSS. She is probably best remembered for her procurement of French naval coats necessary to the Allies' invasion of North Africa, which she accomplished by tricking a man connected to the Vichy French embassy into giving them to her. Not only did she steal French naval code books from the safe in his locked room, she also stole his heart. After the war, they were married, and they spent the rest of their lives together. Climbing. Jo March, the heroine of Little Women, declares that no girl can be her friend who refuses to climb trees and leap fences. Louisa May Alcott wrote that book in 1868. British author Charlotte Yonge wrote in the late 1800s that girls showed a wholesome delight in rushing about at full speed, playing at active games, climbing trees, rowing boats, making dirt pies, and the like. Award-winning actress Bea Richards penned a poem in 1951 called Keep Climbing, Girls, in which she urged girls to climb right up to the toppermost bough of the very tallest tree. To keep you in tune with your adventuresome foremothers, here are some tree climbing tips that Jo March might have suggested to new friends, along with some ideas for shimmying up ropes. Trees. The key to successful tree climbing is understanding that you are not pulling yourself up vertically. Tree climbing is hard enough without trying to entirely defy gravity. You are sturdily pushing the plane of your body into the tree diagonally, while your arms reach around the trunk and shimmying up inch by inch. Tree climbing doesn't necessarily cause injury, but falling out of one surely does. Climb with caution. Ropes. Read these directions and trust that when you're standing in front of a rope in gym class, they will make good sense. Here's how to tackle the miraculous feat that is rope climbing. Grab the rope with your hands and pull the rope down as you jump up. This sounds odd, but it works. Right after you grab and jump, grapple the rope with your legs so that one ankle wraps around the rope, then end in a position where your 2 feet hold tightly against the rope. You are up. To climb. Hold tight with your legs and stretch your arms one after the other, as high up as possible on the rope. Now comes the secret trick. Use your stomach muscles or abdominals to crunch your legs up toward your arms. You may not move far, but keep shimmying inch by inch. Reach your arms, crunch with your stomach, and grab the rope with your feet. As your torso gets stronger, and your arms and legs too, rope climbing will become much easier and all the more gratifying. Climbing walls at gyms are a great place to practice. Keep climbing, but remember, once you go up, you still have to figure out how to safely get down. Queens of the Ancient World. 3. Cleopatra of Egypt, Queen of Kings. Cleopatra VII was the last of a long line of ancient Egyptian queens. She ruled Egypt for 21 years, from 51 to 30 BC, and was famously linked with the Roman generals Julius Caesar and Mark Antony. It was the Greek historian Plutarch, from 46 to 122 AD, however, who turned Cleopatra into a legend. Plutarch reports that although she was not conventionally beautiful, Cleopatra's persona was bewitching and irresistible. The sound of her voice brought pleasure, like an instrument of many strings, and she was intelligent, charming, witty, and outrageous. Cleopatra's City, Alexandria. Cleopatra was born in 70 BC, one of King Ptolemy XII's 6 children. She came of age in Alexandria, Egypt's capital city and a bustling port on the Mediterranean Sea. The Pharos Lighthouse, one of the 7 wonders of the ancient world, gleamed over Alexandria's harbor and welcomed ships and people to this vibrant and cosmopolitan city. The celebrated mathematician Euclid had lived there and published his 13-volume Elements, filled with all the known principles of geometry and algebra. Alexandria's marble library was the largest in the world, and philosophers in the Greek tradition of Aristotle and Plato roamed Alexandria's streets. Egypt was wealthy besides. Craftspeople produced glass, metal, papyrus writing sheets, and cloth. The fertile countryside produced grain that was shipped all over the Mediterranean region to make bread. Queen of a Threatened Nation. Despite this grand history, in the 50s BC, Egypt was struggling. Rome's armies had already conquered most of the nearby nations. Egypt remained independent, but no one knew how long it would be able to survive Rome's expansion. Cleopatra's father, Ptolemy XII, had made an unequal alliance with Rome. He had lost several territories, like the island of Cyprus, and faced political rebellions from his own children. When her father died in 51 BC, Cleopatra was only 18 years old. Still, she was named his successor, along with her 12-year-old brother, Ptolemy XIII. Throughout her long reign, she vowed to protect Egypt's independence. She did so until the bitter end with the help of a strong navy and her romantic alliances with the most powerful men of Rome. Cleopatra and Julius Caesar. When Cleopatra became queen, Rome was embroiled in its own civil drama. Rome had long been a republic that prided itself in democracy and in measured rule by its Senate. Now, ambitious men were taking over. Three of these power-hungry men, Julius Caesar, Pompey, and Crassus, secretly joined forces as the first triumvirate in 60 BC to gain more control. Soon, though, they began to fight each other. In 48 BC, Julius Caesar conquered Gaul, just north of Italy. Flush with the thrill of victory, he led his soldiers back to Rome. There was a tradition that no general's soldiers were to cross the Rubicon River into the city, but Caesar ignored that and brought his army across. He waged armed civil war against his now enemy Pompey and the Senate, on land and at sea. Pompey fled to Alexandria with Caesar in pursuit. Alexandria had fallen into violence. Cleopatra and her brother were quarreling, as each tried to steal power from the other, and there was no law and order. The sibling rulers looked to Roman rivals Pompey and Julius Caesar, knowing they needed to make an alliance, and not knowing which of them they should trust. As the fighting in Alexandria worsened, Cleopatra fled the city with her younger sister. At the same time, one of her brother's fighters, feeling emboldened, assassinated Pompey. He hoped the act would endear him to Julius Caesar, who would then take the brother's side and install him as sole pharaoh of Egypt. However, when Caesar saw the remains of Pompey, including his signet ring with an emblem of a lion holding a sword in his paws, he was furious. Roman generals had their own sense of honor, and this was no way for the life of a famed Roman leader to end. Julius Caesar was angry with the brother and banished him from Egypt. And so in 47 BC, Cleopatra became the sole queen of Egypt. Julius Caesar named her pharaoh and queen of kings, and Cleopatra styled herself as the incarnation of the Egyptian mother goddess Isis. She and Julius Caesar also fell in love. The Roman conqueror and the Egyptian queen had a child together. They named him Ptolemy Caesar, thus joining the traditional names of Egypt and Rome. His nickname was Caesarion. Soon after Caesarion's birth, a cabal of Roman senators who feared Caesar's growing power assassinated him on the infamous Ides of March, the 15th of March, 44 BC. Cleopatra and her son had been with Caesar in Rome, and after his death, they returned by ship to Alexandria. Having seen Roman politics up close, Cleopatra knew that Rome would play an important role in her future, but she did not know how. Cleopatra and Mark Antony. After Caesar's death, Rome was ruled by a second triumvirate, Octavian, Lepidus, and Mark Antony. Antony was in charge of Rome's eastern provinces and had his eye set on Egypt. In 42 BC, he summoned Cleopatra to a meeting. Cleopatra finally agreed to meet Mark Antony in the city of Tarsus. She arrived in grandeur, on a golden ship with brilliant purple sails, and demanded that he come aboard and talk with her there. They too fell in love, and 9 months later she gave birth to their twins, named Alexander Helios and Cleopatra Selene II. Mark Antony was worn out by the political life of Rome. Despite his great popularity with the Roman people, he was losing political ground to his nemesis, the brilliant Octavian. Antony moved to Alexandria to live with Cleopatra, and they had another child. Cleopatra's fate would now be inseparable from that of Mark Antony and his foe Octavian. Octavian wanted Egypt's wealth, and he wanted Mark Antony's power. Julius Caesar had named Octavian his legal heir before he died, But Octavian still feared that Caesarion, Caesar's son with Cleopatra, would one day challenge him for the leadership of Rome. Octavian and the Roman Senate declared war against Antony and Cleopatra. Octavian's general, Agrippa, captured one of Antony's Greek cities, Methone. On a September morning in 31 BC, Antony and Cleopatra commanded a flotilla of ships to arrive at the Gulf of Actium on the western coast of Greece to win the city back. Egypt's last queen. The battle would be a disaster for Cleopatra. Before day's end, she would turn her ships back to Alexandria, followed by Mark Antony, who had lost many ships and many men. Their day was over. Soon Octavian's forces threatened Alexandria. With Antony already dead by his own hand, Cleopatra chose to kill herself rather than be taken prisoner and displayed in Octavian's triumphal march through the streets of Rome. Still considering Caesarion a threat, Octavian had the 12-year-old put to death. He brought Cleopatra's 3 children with Mark Antony to Rome, where they were raised by Octavian's sister, Octavia, who had also been Antony's Roman wife and was now his widow. One era ended and another began. Cleopatra was independent Egypt's last queen and reigning pharaoh. Having defeated Cleopatra, Octavian declared Egypt a Roman province. He commandeered Egypt's immense treasure to pay his soldiers. Having vanquished Mark Antony, Octavian ushered in the Pax Romana, or Roman peace, and became the first emperor of Rome. Words to impress. Strunk and White, in The Elements of Style, tell us about sesquipedalian words. Do not be tempted by a $20 word when there is a 10-center handy, ready, and able. But daring girls are never afraid to drop a spectacular, multisyllabic bombshell when necessary. Here are some you can use when quotidian vocabulary fails. Aleatoric. Dependent on luck or a random outcome, like a roll of the dice. Aurora just laughed when doubters attributed her triumph over the pirate rogues to aleatoric influences. Brobdingnagian. Gigantic, enormous, tremendous. Lydia made constant use of her Brobdingnagian vocabulary. Callipygian. Having shapely buttocks. Jen's Callipygian beauty was matched only by her strong right hook. Crepuscular. Dim. Resembling or having to do with twilight. Janet's habit of planning all her best pranks to occur immediately after dinner led her mother to declare her utterly crepuscular in nature. Diaphanous. Almost entirely transparent or translucent. Halloween had been a success, thought Belinda, even though little kids kept bumping into her costume's diaphanous fairy wings. Echolalia. Repeating or echoing a person's speech, often in a pathological way. The baby's curious echolalia almost sounded like real conversation. Frangible. Fragile. Easily broken, brittle. After seeing what happened to his brothers, the third little pig resolved to build his house from a less frangible material. Frustraneous. Vain, useless, frustrating. After several frustraneous attempts, Katie gave up on trying to get her sister's attention. Gustatory. Of or pertaining to taste or tasting. Rachel dug into her dinner with gustatory glee. Hagiology. Literature dealing with the lives of saints. A list of saints. Julie's notebook was practically a hagiology of current boy bands. Ineluctable. Inevitable. Inescapable. From the Latin word luctari, to wrestle. Sarah was unable to escape the ineluctable gaze of her mother. Jejune. Immature, uninteresting, dull, lacking nutrition. Molly resolved to use an interesting vocabulary, the better to avoid appearing jejune. Neural. A knob, knot, or other small protuberance. One of a series of small ridges or grooves on the surface or edge of a metal object, such as a thumb screw, to aid in gripping. Samira learned to rock climb by grabbing onto the knurls all the way up the wall. Languorous. Lacking spirit or liveliness. Dreamy. Lazy. Amelia spent a languorous day by the pool. Luculent. Easily understood, clear, or lucid. Sometimes Brianna's homework needed to be a little more luculent. Mellifluous. Flowing with sweetness or honey, smooth and sweet. Anna always enjoyed chorus. She knew her voice was mellifluous. Miasma. Foul vapors emitted from rotting matter, unwholesome air or atmosphere. Emmy held her nose as she passed the miasma of what her little brother referred to as the stinky parking garage. Natalicious. Pertaining to one's birthday. Mary designed elaborate invitations to announce her natalicious festivities. Nemesis. A source of harm, an opponent that cannot be beaten, mythological Greek goddess of vengeance. On a good day, Christina's brother was her ally. On a bad day, he was her nemesis. Obsequious. Fawning. Attentive in an ingratiating manner. Eager to win her parents' approval, Vanessa was polite to the point of being obsequious. Persiflage. Light banter. Frivolous discussion. "We must be careful to keep our persiflage to a minimum," Nola whispered to Margot during class. Quiescence. Stillness. Quietness. Inactivity. Esme reveled in the extraordinary quiescence of early morning when she awoke before anyone else. Quotidian. Everyday, commonplace, ordinary, recurring daily. Dana sighed, bored by the quotidian sameness of it all. Rapprochement. Reconciliation. The reestablishing of cordial relations. After holding a grudge against him for so long, Eleanor felt it was almost a relief to have reached a rapprochement with her brother. Risible. Laughable. Causing laughter. The girls knew they could always count on Jasmine for a risible remark. Sesquipedalian. Characteristic of a long word. Given to using long words. Daring girls are not shy about their sesquipedalian abilities. Sprezzatura. Nonchalance. Effortlessness. After reading the daring book for girls, Erin was able to cartwheel with sprezzatura and verve. Truculent. Pugnacious. Belligerent. Scathing. When Nancy was pushed too far, she became truculent. Ultracrepidarian. Giving opinions or criticizing beyond one's own range of expertise. "I'd tell you what I think about your outfit, but I don't want to be all ultra-crepidarian," said Karen. Vitiate. To weaken, impair, or render invalid. Penelope's debate in class vitiated Rob's argument. Winsome. Sweetly or innocently charming. Surya was too busy building her tree fort to act winsome. Xenophobe. A person who fears or hates foreigners. It was a nerve-wracking moment at the potluck picnic when the neighborhood xenophobe showed up with potato salad. Yawl. A ship's small boat. A yowl or howl. Lainey let out a loud yawl as the boat tipped over. Zaftik. Having a shapely figure. From the Yiddish word zaftik, juicy. Beyonce was proud of her strong zaftik figure. Zeitgeist. The spirit of the time, the outlook of a particular generation. Shonda was convinced the latest pop star embodied the zeitgeist of middle school. Three silly pranks. Think boys are the only ones good at pranking? Think again. Here are three classic pranks for any daring girl. Stink bombs. The old-fashioned kind, from the herb valerian. Head outdoors with the following. A small jar with a screw-on lid. Measuring spoons. Any kind of vinegar you can snag from the kitchen. Valerian root powder. This is the key ingredient for a stink bomb. You can find this at any grocery store that stocks vitamins and herbal remedies. It comes in capsules that can be opened and emptied. If you can only find valerian tea, mash it into a powder. Mix one or more teaspoons of the powder with 2 teaspoons of vinegar. Close the jar very, very quickly and shake. When you're ready to set off the stink bomb, open the jar. Don't throw it. Yell skunk and run. Short sheeting beds. For this prank, you'll need to know the old-fashioned skill of making a bed, the fancy way, with tucked-in sheets. Here's a refresher. Fit the bottom sheet over the mattress. Tuck the top sheet under the foot of the bed and along at least part of the sides. Lay the blanket on top, tuck that in too, and then neatly fold the top edge of the sheet over the blanket, about 6 inches or so. There. Stand back and observe your handiwork, because you will want the short-sheeted bed to look the same way. To short-sheet a bed, you merely reposition the top sheet. Instead of tucking it in at the foot of the bed, tuck it in at the head of the bed. Lay out the sheet and halfway down the bed, stop, and fold the sheet back toward the pillows. Place the blanket on top and fold a few inches of the sheet on top for that neat, just-made look. This bed looks normal, but just try and stretch your legs out. Important. Don't do this to anyone whose feelings will be hurt. Only to those you know will laugh hard or at least giggle when they figure it out. Faux blood. Fool your friends with this easily prepared hoax. Needed. Corn syrup. Cornstarch. Red food coloring from the pantry. A jar with a tight lid. A spoon. An eyedropper. Red food coloring can stain, so wear old clothes, although washing with very warm water and strong soap should clean it up. It is best to keep this all outdoors. Mix 4 small drops of food coloring, 2 teaspoons of water, and 1 to 2 teaspoons of cornstarch in the jar. Cover and shake. Pour in 2 tablespoons of corn syrup. Cover and shake again. Use an eyedropper or a spoon to drip the fake blood where you want it. Make up a good story. First aid. First aid is basic care in the event of illness, accident, or injury that can be performed by anyone until professional medical treatment is given. It was a concept first put into practice by the Knights Hospitaller, who came up with the term first aid and founded the Order of St. John in the 11th century to train knights in the treatment of common battlefield injuries. In a life of adventure, accidents are bound to happen, and a daring girl needs to know about first aid, even if she never plans to be injured in battle. The information that follows is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice or treatment. Taking a first aid class will provide even more in-depth instruction, but there are definitely actions you can take to help in the event of injury. Here are some tips and techniques to keep in mind. Remember your ABCs. When accidents happen, sometimes the first casualty is plain old common sense. It's easy to panic and forget about what's important, but these mnemonics can help you remember what to do. Mnemonic devices are formulas, usually in the form of rhymes, phrases, or acronyms to help you remember things. Some of the most familiar mnemonics in first aid are the 3 P's and the 3 B's, the ABCs and CPR, and RICE. The 3 P's. Preserve life, prevent further injury, promote recovery. Remembering the 3 P's helps you keep in mind what your goal is in responding to an accident or injury, making sure the person stays alive, ensuring that nothing is done to further injure the person, and taking action to help the person get better. The three B's: breathing, bleeding, bones. The three B's remind a first aid responder of what is most important to check when a person is injured, and the order of importance in treating. Is the person breathing? Is the person bleeding? Are there any broken bones? ABCs. The ABCs stand for airway, breathing, and circulation. And remembering this helps remind you to check that an injured person has a clear airway passage, isn't choking, is able to breathe, and has a pulse. Open the airway by lifting the person's chin with your fingers, gently tilting their head back. Listen for breathing sounds. Look for a rise and fall of the chest, and feel for breathing movement. Check for a pulse by placing two fingers on the person's neck between the voice box and the muscle on the side of the neck. If a person is not breathing and does not have a pulse, call 911 and begin CPR. CPR. CPR stands for cardiopulmonary resuscitation, a procedure performed on people whose heart or breathing has stopped. Once you have checked the ABCs, if a person is unresponsive, call 911. Begin CPR on an adult by pinching the person's nose as you give two breaths into their mouth. Using two fingers, check the person's pulse at the carotid artery, the neck, just under the jaw, between the voice box and the muscle on the side of the neck, for 5 to 10 seconds. If there is no pulse, make sure the person is on their back, then place your hands one on top of the other on the lower half of the chest. Press down to give 15 compressions, about one every second. Give two more breaths, pinching the nose and breathing directly into the person's mouth. Continue 15 compressions with two breaths for 4 cycles. After 1 minute, recheck pulse and breathing. If the person has regained a pulse, discontinue compressions. If the person is still not breathing, continue giving a breath every 5 seconds until help arrives. When performing CPR on an infant, use two fingers instead of your whole hand.